There we go.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. And the scores.
Okay, my name is
Dallas.
Nice reps. Football, basketball, volleyball, baseball, softball, soccer.
We need their text.
In order to purchase kind of DISD, you must sign in. In order to purchase, you must sign in.
Well, it was.
It's not a.
You don't have to.
Oh, those beans.
They came out okay?
Yes, excellent.
I don't measure, so every time sale.
Yeah, excellent.
Do you not have a Gmail account?
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Okay, I'm ready. All right. That is cool, huh?
Love it.
Calling to order a special board meeting of the Board of Trustees for Canandaigua ISD. It is August 5th, 2014, and it is 6:13. Ms. Gomez.
The roll call. Mr. Coronado.
Here.
Mrs. Gonzalez.
Here.
Mr. Medina.
Present.
Mrs. Mendoza.
Here.
Mrs. Quintana.
Here.
Mr. Rodriguez.
Present.
Mrs. Jones.
Here.
Item 2, special presentation, Eric Evans, CEO, Sierra Providence Northwest Hospital.
I'm going to take this out because I cannot stand behind that. First of all, I want to say thank you for allowing me a few minutes, and Dr. Galavis and honorable board members, thank you for your time. My name is Eric Evans. I am blessed to serve as the CEO of Sierra Providence Health Network. We don't yet know who the CEO of Northwest Hospital will be, but we will give you that as we get closer. We are, as you can imagine, in the throes of finishing up design work. We'll talk a little bit about the timing. For those of you who don't know, our groundbreaking is going to be August the 14th. The pad site will be done about that time, and we probably will be vertical in some form or fashion by the end of the year, but we'll talk more about that in a second. So first of all, my pleasure to be here. Thank you for allowing me a few minutes of your time. I want to first of all just say how excited we are and how excited I am about being in El Paso. I've been here 2 years. I have two little boys. They turn 2 and 4 next week, and it's been a fantastic place for me to be from a city perspective. And I will tell you, too, that we are really, really excited about where the city's heading. And you can probably guess that. I mean, I've worked very hard to make sure that we're investing what we should be here. And just to give you a quick summary, we are right now in the process of redoing both the hospitals downtown. So you're going to see major construction inside and out of Sierra and Providence, about $120 million of renovation there. The new hospital out here will be a minimum of $120 million, likely much more than that, and we'll talk about that in a second. We just finished a brand new tower on the Eastside Hospital that was a $70 million investment. And so you put all that together, you know, over a five-year period, we're about $350, $400 million that we're investing in the community, which is fantastic. I will tell you, 75% of that or more will be local. So we're absolutely committed to making sure we use local contractors, making sure we keep jobs local, and of course, obviously the hospitals create a lot of positions, and they're overall very high-paying jobs, so we'll talk about that in a second. So, but that's our side of the story. I'm also really excited. Man, it seems like every week there's a new employer coming to the west side. There's a lot of stuff going on in Santa Teresa that's going to have great impact here as well. And so what a fun time to be part of the region. There's a buzz in the city. Love the new baseball team. We're obviously a big supporter there. It's been so much fun just to see the city kind of coming to life with all this stuff coming. And obviously that is translating for you guys too. As you expand your school district, as you think about growth, which I think is exciting. I will tell you, I want to first of all thank you all in this room. I mentioned this to Dr. Galavis earlier. You guys are doing God's work, because I will tell you, I'm a product of public schools in Indiana. I grew up in a very small community. first person in my family to go to college. And what you do and the opportunities you provide and make for people is it's tremendous service. And so thank you for that. Okay, with that, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. You might imagine we have a very, we're very proud of our vision statement. I will focus on that one of the things that we think makes Sierra Providence this difference is the passion of our people. It always comes down to your staff. You guys know this as educators. It comes down to the folks you have, how you keep them motivated. One of the really cool things is I get to get up and go to work every day with 3,500 other folks who have self-selected to help other people in their absolutely most vulnerable moments. And that is a kind of an interesting group to be at work with every day. It's an interesting family. It's a group of folks who are very, very talented, very highly educated. They can do a lot of things, and they chose every day to really do things for folks with their absolutely most vulnerable moments. I'm blessed to do that. A little bit about us. You guys know we have the two hospitals downtown. Providence is our oldest hospital. Of course, we acquired that in 1995. That's when the PDN Foundation was formed. Sierra Medical Center we built in 1976. They both are going through full renovation. I'll tell you, in some ways, Sierra is in more of need than Providence because Sierra's stuck in that really bad, like, early 80s period. If you guys have been there, it's got that peach brown. It's like terrible colors. And so we're slowly going to be renovating that entire facility, as we will at Providence. One of the things I'll point out for our three hospitals, actually, if you count Providence Children's, I'll talk about that in a second, four hospitals, is that when we redo the hospitals downtown, we are not going to be all things to all people at both hospitals. One of the mistakes that I think we've made historically is we're 2 miles apart, and we try to recreate everything in both hospitals. So when I got here, they both had a medical oncology department. They both had a, and rather than trying to do everything, when we redo these hospitals, we're going to create centers of excellence. So Sierra will be four things that are going to be great at. This means the only things they will do, but they will be great at cardio. We'll have a heart hospital there, a whole floor. They will be great at orthopedics. They will be great at neurosciences. One of the things I'm really proud of at Sierra is we brought in a neurointerventional radiologist who does brain coil. So that may sound kind of interesting. Let me explain what that is. If you were a patient here 3 years ago in the city of El Paso and you missed the window for a stroke, meaning that you were outside this, there's like a 4 to 6 hour window after a stroke where we can give a clot busting drug. After that point, and if you could talk to ED staff, they would tell you, after that point, basically, you come to the ED, we'd send you to the ICU, but the outcome was not great, right? One of the really cool things about having a neurointerventionalist in a neuro suite is those patients now, we can actually go in, remove the clot, put in a coil, and go right into the brain through a cath lab, minimally invasive procedure, and those people can now walk out of our facility. It's absolutely incredible. So we're excited about where neuroscience is going there, and then rehab. So that's what Sierra is going to focus on. Providence will focus on women's and children's, as you might imagine, oncology, urology, and geriatrics. And so what does that mean? Well, it allows us to be more specialized and to really dedicate resources and physicians at the hospital that's going to be the center of excellence. And so if you can imagine, we have the new hospital on the east side, we'll have the new hospital on the west side, and then we're going to have these two tertiary quaternary centers of excellence downtown that will be very, very specialized. Now, the good news for you is the vast majority of what you're going to ever need will be done in the hospital here on the west side, and we'll talk about that in just a second. I would also point out we have a huge outpatient footprint. So we have three, soon to be four, urgent care centers. Why urgent care centers? If you have a child, if you lived here 5 years ago and you had a child that was sick at 9 o'clock at night, your only option was the ED. Ridiculous, right? So we have to be part of the solution. I'll give you a perfect example. On the east side, it's our busiest emergency department. A vast majority of their visits are kids. And a vast majority of those shouldn't be in the emergency department. So we built a kids urgent care right across from the hospital where literally we're able to send those patients to the appropriate level of care. It's cheaper. It's the right thing to do. We also own 7 imaging centers here in the city. We own 2 ambulatory surgery centers that are partnered with physicians. Paso del Norte, which is along Mesa, and El Paso Day Surgery, which is over near Sierra. So lots of things going on in the outpatient. You'll continue to see us build more urgent care centers. Our goal is we need to have the right access in a convenient way so that people can go to the right place that makes the most sense for the issue they have so we're not wasting resources. All right, so there's kind of an overview of all of our clinics across the city. I will point out a couple things that have changed this year. We opened a new full-service emergency department in the Northeast. It's right at the corner of 54 and Trans Mountain. Basically, it's at Star Magri, actually. It was an urgent care center. What was interesting in the Northeast is that urgent care center was so busy. And even when we closed at 10 o'clock at night, there'd be a line. I mean, it was incredible. And we realized it was a tremendous need. The other thing, when we think about expansion, and I'll talk about this in the context of the West Side, too, When we think about expansion, one of the things we do is we go talk to our EMS providers and we say, gosh, where's your pain points? So they would have told you a few months ago the two biggest pain points they had. One was the west side, because quite honestly, if something happens in Santa Teresa or far west, it's a long way. The other was the northeast, where literally the ambulance would be out of service for 45 minutes at minimum to get a patient downtown and come back out, which is obviously a service issue. So that ED in the northeast has 24/7 ED physicians, has a blood bank, has a CT, has emergency backup power, and takes ambulance traffic. And it's been extremely busy. We'll be opening it. We just opened last week an urgent care center in the northeast too, because we need to have both. One of the really cool things about that, actually, for you guys in the West is I believe that most of the people from the Northeast will start accessing this hospital once it opens, because it's literally just over Trans Mountain. It'll be easier than going down 54. So we see that as a way to really connect our two communities. The other thing I would mention, before I forget, is we bought about 10 acres out in Horizon, and so we're building a freestanding ED helipad center out there, because there's actually almost, you guys know this, about 75,000 people now in Horizon. And if you look at that catchment area, it's about 125,000 people. So to put that in perspective, it's a similar size to when we built the Eastside Hospital for that kind of demographic. And so we are expanding out there to meet that need as well. So lots of growth going on throughout the city to meet the healthcare needs of the community. I'm very proud of the fact that our direct economic impact is about $167 million here. We have 3,000 plus employees. You can kind of see too, we're also a big taxpayer. So we pay $12 million a year in taxes, which certainly goes to the school district. One of the good news for you, too, is this new Westside Hospital will be a big taxpayer. And certainly that'll be something that I think you guys will all feel good about. Let me say this about, because there's always a lot of conjecture around for-profit, non-profit hospitals. There really isn't that much difference between either of us anymore. I've worked with a lot of folks on both sides of the fence. The way we run our hospitals is very similar. I think the real question comes down to, with the extra margin, do we want to let the health system decide what to do with it, or want the community decide what to do with it? Because really our overall earnings margins are about the same. So it comes down to the fact that we think that the taxpaying model will be beneficial to you, and certainly we feel like the community can make a good decision as far as what to do with those funds. You can see, I mentioned earlier, the investments we've made in the community. One thing that's not widely known is Sierra Providence, if you look at the combined Medicaid uninsured population, we take care of 40% of those folks. So there's a common misperception that only county hospitals or only not-for-profit take care of those folks. Actually, the laws, the legal implications, and even just the right thing to do. In my hospital, I don't want anyone in my emergency department to know the payer of any patient. Their only job is to take care of people. Our job is to manage the financials, right? So somebody walks into our emergency department, we take care of them. So 40% of the uninsured Medicaid population we take care of. Another fact that's not widely known is the private hospitals here in the city take roughly half of all uninsured patients. So while the county hospital takes a disproportionate share, which they're funded for, half of it's actually taken up by tax-paying entities. So I would just point that out as just something to keep in mind. We support a lot of community activities. We give away hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars each year. I think we've donated about $2.5 million over the last 4 years. We'll continue to do that for local charities. We're very, very involved in the community. We're very committed to quality. So I will tell you that you may say that that sounds probably, of course you're committed to quality, you're a hospital. I will tell you that in hospitals, the incentives have been pretty bad for a lot of years, right? So you could have four hospitals in a city, and the one that had the most readmissions and issues might be the one that actually bills the most, right? A lot of that incentives on how that works. Very proud of Tenet Healthcare. We've been a leader in transparency. So you can go to our websites, you can see how we stack up. We're well above the national averages when you look at evidence-based medicine. You look at our efforts around readmissions. We've done some really great work on reducing readmissions, eliminating to reducing infection rates. And so we have a lot of stuff. If you come to my hospital, I'd be happy to show you around. One of the things that my background was not in healthcare. I was actually an engineer. I worked with General Motors as an industrial engineer for several years. Is in every department, we do daily lean management walks where every department has a board with their top four issues. They track how they're doing from the day before. We immediately address issues. So my whole senior management team, between 8:30 and 10:30 every day, all they do is go out to the floors and spend time trying to make sure we solve those real issues with our department. So very, very focused on quality. I'm not gonna go through, I'm very proud of the awards we've received. We do provide great care. We have outstanding technology. A little bit about the West Side. You guys know this stuff, but the West Side, you know, if you just look at El Paso in general, retail sales grew by 41% from 2000 to 2011. pretty staggering statistic. 21.4% growth compared to the national average of 11.2% across that same time period. If you look at the west side, it's 26.6%. So pretty impressive number, right? So lots of reasons we're looking at here. If you look at the west side PSA demographics, you can kind of see we are growing at about the same rate as El Paso, which is a whole percentage point above the average U.S. city, right? So we are certainly a place that has a lot of bright days ahead of it. You can kind of see our location. We can talk about this for a second. It's at the corner of Trans Mountain and Wrestler. So you guys have probably seen the dirt moving. It's exciting. This is kind of what the hospital is going to look like right there. So it's going to have a glass front. This is a two-story entrance. It's a five-story hospital. You can see there's a two-story walkway here. There will be a similar matching building. It's going to be a gorgeous campus. If you guys have seen our Eastside Hospital, you can have a feel for kind of the facilities we build. We expect it to be open by July or August of 16. So we are on a very fast track. So we actually are designing and building this hospital in about 2 years, which is a rapid pace for a hospital, given all the complexities of equipment and everything else we have to do. There will also be next to it, and you don't see this here, it's going to be over here, there's going to be 110,000 square foot medical office building. I do want to give you guys a sense of how hospitals have changed. This hospital will be 360,000 square feet. To put that in perspective, 360,000 square feet, it'll be built to be 140 beds, although 30 beds will initially be shelled. We bought 50 acres, so we also have plenty of room for a second tower, a second MOB. We do anticipate growth. What's kind of fascinating about this, though, this is how much medicine has changed. In 1976, when we built Sierra, Sierra is a 350-bed hospital. Sierra is only 350,000 square feet. So this hospital at less than half the beds will be bigger than Sierra Medical Center from a square footage standpoint. Now, part of that also has to do with this is going to be a teaching hospital, so we'll spend some time talking about that. We have to have an auditorium. We have to have a lot more call room for residents to stay over. We have to have bigger patient rooms. So there is definitely an expense to being a teaching hospital, but we think there's a lot of benefits, not just for us, but for the community. So we'll talk more about the Texas Tech partnership that I'm very, very excited about. There's a couple different angles for you. Okay, so I mentioned this is going to be about 140 beds. So let's talk about the Texas Tech partnership. So we are very, very excited about this. One thing people don't know about Tenet, so we're owned by Tenet, a Fortune 200 company, is that Tenet, behind New York Presbyterian, Tenet's hospitals train more residents than anyone else in the U.S. So we have a lot of academic relationships. We own St. Louis University Hospital. We own Hahnemann University Hospital, which is the downtown partner in Philadelphia for Drexel. We own a Detroit Medical Center, which is the partner with Wayne State, which trains a bunch of residents. And so we have a bunch of teaching opportunities that we bring, we have a bunch of teaching experience we bring. I will tell you that Dr. De La Rosa and the new president, Dr. Lang, fantastic folks to work with. We're really, really excited. I think it's a particularly good time for us and Texas Tech. So if you look at the medical schools across the state, they're building a new one in Austin, as you know. They're looking at building a new one down in the valley, Carthage and Brownsville. There's the new New Mexico School of Medicine you've heard about. It is a particularly important time that we expand the medical school here and that we help it reach its full potential, which I don't think it can without having a good private partner. I think in particular, this particular public-private partnership is one that's going to be fantastic. So by year five, after it opens, we will eventually be training 75 residents a year there, which is fantastic. That doesn't even count the nurses, the medical students. So huge, huge opportunity there. And I will say for this group especially, we want to make sure we integrate high school students wherever we can. So in my last hospital, we were very, very good at doing job shadowing, exposing folks that are interested in healthcare to all the possibilities out there. I was joking earlier with Dr. Galapagos that when I was coming out of high school, I had no idea what I wanted to do. And my guidance counselor said, well, you could be an English teacher or an engineer. And I remember thinking, wow, I don't know that I want to be an English teacher. So that's how I ended up, and I look back at that's how narrow my scope was. And I think the cool thing about having a teaching hospital here is that we can expose students to so many different healthcare possibilities. And they're going to see residents. They're going to see people going through that challenging time, but also going through what they can accomplish. And so I think exposing them to that is going to be a fantastic opportunity for all of us. It'll be a full-service hospital. So basically, if you're familiar with Sierra Providence East, it's going to provide all the same services that East does. It will not do open hearts, because it doesn't make sense to do that at every hospital. Actually, you want to do that in one place and do it really well. It will not do brain coiling, But most everything you will need, 95% of what you need is going to be able to be done here. But when it can't be, it'll be done downtown. But certainly we expect this to be a full-service hospital. Obviously, we'll have a helipad. One of the beautiful things about this hospital where it's located is there's not houses all around it yet, because that is the biggest fighting point when you build a new hospital is nobody wants the helipad because it's noisy and the helicopters are coming in and out. Luckily, we don't have that issue right now. Maybe at some point. It really will broaden access. You know, when you think about one of the things you guys might not realize, 11% of our admissions at Providence are actually from southern New Mexico. And so there's a lot of patients from Las Cruces that we think will access this hospital, obviously Santa Teresa, West El Paso. The fact that the teaching hospital allows us to do some more complex things, which we're excited about. We're going to be very, very integrated with Medical Centers of the Americas, which I serve on the board of to do a lot of research. I think one thing that we haven't taken full advantage of in El Paso is we have a demographic that looks like the U.S. will look like in 30 years. We need to be doing a lot more medical research here in this city. And so that's going to be a big, big focus for us, too. So, you got to watch me with these things. I always take them. Okay. So just a little bit of a breakdown. This is going to be too much detail for you guys, but it'll have an ICU. It'll have a small NICU. I already mentioned the size. Again, about 75 residents, or excuse me, these are actually medical students, about 70 medical students that first year. Interestingly, until we get it built, those medical students will actually be at Providence. So they start at Providence next year until this opens. The nursing students, we're going to have a big nursing training program there as well, which will be great. And then again, eventually we expect to have 75 new residency slots, fellowship slots for specialists. So this is going to be training primary care, but it will also be training cardiologists, orthopedic surgeons, you name it, we're pretty excited about that. Let's talk a little about the jobs. So this number is really low. This is our estimate. So 300 jobs from the hospital perspective. That doesn't include things that we outsource, like food service and housekeeping. The average salary is $45,000. The reality of it is that job number is low. So you look 5 years out, when East was first opened, that's about right. 5 years out, they had about 900 people. So, you know, we do expect that to be a much larger number. That doesn't count the physicians we're recruiting in. So over the first 3 years, the goal will be to recruit in 45 new physicians to this area. They each have 3.5 employees, right? So there's another 120, 150 jobs. And there will be additional, I will tell you, when a hospital gets built, if you go look around most campuses, there's also a lot of additional economic activity it drives. And so we think all of that's going to be great for Canateo and Canateo ISD for sure. Again, we're going to go local with almost all of those things as we talked about. Let's see. So you guys already heard about the timing, summer, late summer, early fall of 2016. So I've talked way too much. I certainly would love to take questions. We are thrilled to be your new neighbor. We're a neighbor you know well anyway, because we're not that far down the road, but it's nice to be able to have a really superb access point out here for you guys. I will tell you too, part of our commitment to you is we are constantly working on making healthcare more value added. So I'm gonna take a little moment here to say, healthcare right now, the math doesn't work. You guys are all aware of this. We have to get much smarter with healthcare as a resource. We have to be much farther ahead of wellness. We have to keep people out of our hospital. Going forward, what's really kind of cool for me is over the next 5 or 10 years, the whole way hospitals get paid will change dramatically. Our goal is and should be to keep people out of our beds. That historically has not been the impetus, but that's where we're heading. A couple of really staggering statistics for the state of Texas. We have 6.1 million uninsured people in the state of Texas. I find that appalling. In a state that does as well as we do. 64% of those people are working. Right? 64% of people are working. 1.1 million are caught in what they call the gap. So we chose in the state of Texas not to expand Medicaid, which I disagree with, but I think there's lots of idealistic reasons why you could say that's okay. The problem is we said no, but we don't have another solution. So my answer is, I don't really care what we do, but the current status quo doesn't work very well. So 1.1 million people are caught in a gap between they make too much money to qualify for Medicaid, and they make too little to qualify for the exchange. So let me give you an example. If you're a single mom in El Paso, and you have one child, and you work full time, don't take any vacation days, don't take any days off, don't get sick, you make about $15,500, a minimum wage. If you have one child, the child will, at that income level, will actually qualify for Medicaid. But as an adult, if you make more than 12% of the federal poverty limit in the state of Texas, you don't have qualification. So if you make more than like $4,000, $4,500, something like that, you will not qualify. And so, unfortunately, that same lady, if she made $500 more, would actually get fully subsidized in the exchange. So there's a lot of, there's 1.1 million Texans that are stuck in the gap between the fact that we didn't expand Medicaid and what you need to qualify in the exchange. So one thing we're trying to figure out together is how do we serve that group better? It really is an important topic because obviously you guys want healthy families, healthy children. It's not all about access, but certainly if we can get them access earlier, then hopefully they're not walking into the emergency departments and using up high-cost resources. But I digress a bit. Is there any questions or comments for me about this new project? We are thrilled to be coming here. We're thrilled to work with you guys. I wanted to get out here early just so you guys could see the drawings, so you guys could hear my excitement about being out here. It's going to be a lot of fun. And I would welcome any questions or comments you guys might have.
I have a couple comments, and then one of the major questions, but the comment I have, well, first history, my mom worked for, actually, Providence for an antenna, so I was there when 1995 happened.
Sure.
Grew throughout the process till my mom got disabled, so I grew up with Sandy Young, and
sure.
It used to be,
yep.
So I was actually born in Providence, and so
love the connection. That's one of the great things about working at Sierra Providence is that there's always this connection where I meet somebody, they just know that I work there, and they'll say, oh my gosh, my kids were born there, there's this amazing connection, which I love. Yeah, it's a great history.
So, first I want to thank you first, and the company taking initiative in El Paso, as well as in our district. I think it's critical I don't know if you know, but in the past, our district took stands, especially when it was looking at the county, looking at those clinics, we were first to make sure that they were more transparent about the issue.
Right.
And so hopefully that changes. It would be nice if you were to manage those. It would probably be
we'll have to see how that shakes out, but certainly I do appreciate your candor on that. We want to be a transparent partner and certainly one that works closely with you. And we're excited to be paying taxes to you guys. Here we go.
So the major question that happened, what I want to see is in the future, 5 years out,
sure,
10 years out, how can we really build a partnership where it helps supplying, whether it's the technicians at the early stages.
Yep.
We've talked about it in the past and how we are able to work in that area and then hopefully creating those nurses.
Well, I think we were at the educational session that we had at ADP a few months ago, and I think one of the things that we as business leaders have to do a much better job is of working with you at a much earlier stage. So I will tell you, right now, downtown between Sierra and Providence, we have 150 openings today. And those openings are in positions that require specialized skills that are very, very hard sometimes to get here. Not because we don't have the talent, but because we haven't done the planning ahead of time to have people ready, right? We have very qualified GNs that were graduate nurses that were getting out of school, but it takes another year then to get them ready for the OR, another year for the cath lab. And so some of those things where if we're connecting early, if we have a need for whatever, let's say it's a respiratory therapy tech or a lab tech, the ability to find people who are interested in that earlier, and get them into our programs, get them exposed to it, and find ways to coordinate on that is hugely important. And I will tell you, I'm going to be a partner on that. We just got to work through the details, but that needs to happen broadly, and it hasn't really worked that well yet. But I think there's huge potential.
And I guess that's my major thing. You know, talking about planning stages, how do we look out in
sure.
5, 10 years, whether it's a technical school within the campus area. Next to your old campus, training
sure.
or within the facility, and how can we really, make that open enrollment for all around to make sure that we're supplying.
Absolutely. I think first of all, start with these conversations, and I think we need to get our education and administrators together with your folks early. So, we're not building this thing 2 years away from opening, but the sooner we can start thinking about, hey, what are the models that have really been successful? And I've got a couple from Dallas that I can show you that we use that were, actually one of them was actually written up in Newsweek about just a way to really place people early. So if we can put some structure around that early on and get that planning done, I think that's going to be hugely important. Yeah, I don't want to lose time on that. You're right.
Again, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. Other questions or comments?
Anybody
else? Yes,
ma'am. Ms. Mendoza and I were just sitting here smiling that we never thought we'd have something like this in our Canyon Teo. Never. I mean, it's amazing. And we so welcome you as our new neighbors and good friends.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it's going to be a great partnership, and I think it is. It truly is a win-win. I mean, we're helping Texas Tech meet their full potential. We're bringing training here to the community, and we're bringing in access. And as I talked about earlier, you know, emergency access, timing is critical, and sometimes, you know, getting downtown from the far edges of West El Paso isn't fast enough. So
we've been living that for a long, all our lives.
So
we welcome you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for letting me come speak.
I know you guys have a lot on your plates, but I do appreciate the opportunity.
And don't be a stranger.
I will not be. You guys, seriously, invite me back whenever you want to. We're certainly going to have a webcam on our website so you can kind of see it going up. Of course, you guys can get distracted by it. But it's going to be a lot of fun, and it's going to move quickly. I mean, this is definitely one of those projects that's fast-tracked. It's just a matter of now how quickly can we put it together and get it built. Are there anything else before?
Is there anybody else?
We'll see you on this board.
Mr. Medina.
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
You discussed the design itself. Is it phased in? I'm just curious. Is it phased in, or is it just a complete build to the
bypass? Yeah, so there's what I would say is, The initial hospital itself is 360,000 square feet. It will have 110 beds fully equipped and open when it opens. There'll be 30 beds shelled. And what we found at East, we did this at East, and within 2 years we had to build up the shell space, and then we had to start thinking about building another tower. The good news here is we actually have more acres on this site than we had ever had. So we have 50 acres. And when you look at the plans for the medical school and everything else, I could easily see this having two or three medical office buildings, certainly a second tower. So there's plenty of room to expand over time, which is a great thing for everybody. I think that'll be good. But no, so it's basically the first investment is relatively not staged. I mean, we will have one half of one floor on the fifth floor that will be shelled for future capacity. But in general, it'll be pretty fully equipped and ready to go.
Thank you.
Good question. Yeah.
Anybody else?
Yes.
Mr. Rodriguez.
Can you just talk a little bit, I guess, so overall plan?
Yeah.
I know there's been somebody brought in to, you know, sort of talk about not just a hospital, but
sure,
how to develop that whole area.
Yeah, so I can talk to that a bit. So on campus, there will be the hospital and the medical office building initially on our 50 acres. The developer of the medical office building is MediStar. In that building, Texas Tech will take about half the building, about 60,000 square feet. For faculty, for teaching, for student space, etc. The other half of that will be for private physicians. And so private physicians it's going to be a very nice public-private partnership. We need them on campus. They're probably going to have the opportunity to buy into the building. So there's going to be that development on campus. Around the campus, the things you can expect to see, skilled nursing facilities. So you can expect to see, typically around hospitals, you'll see places that need our support, skilled nursing facilities, long-term acute care hospitals. You're going to see a lot of medical office development because physicians like to be near the hospital. It makes their life easy. I think you could expect to see hotel development. I think you expect to see retail development. Typically, when you look around hospitals, especially in a fast-growing market like this where hospitals come in and anchor, you see a ton of development around there. So I know the landowners around there are pretty excited. Certainly, we've had a lot of interest and calls from other healthcare providers outside of just acute care. That we will see building there, but yeah, no, I think if you would do a survey nationally, if you look up some of the economic impact statistics around not just what happens with the hospital, but the spinoff and all the associated businesses and job ads, we see that as being a pretty big positive. I don't have the exact numbers for you, but I think you'll be pleased with kind of where that development goes. And then, of course, you know, we're kind of right in the middle of the new home development section there too, so we see that being a boon for all of us. Yeah, good question. Did I answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
I would also like to thank you.
Sure, my pleasure.
Coming in and showing us, it's exciting, it's amazing.
It is. It's an exciting project. You know, being an administrator, I will tell you, there's not many chances in your career that you get a chance to build something like this from the ground up, and especially a teaching hospital. There's, you know, if you look across the country, you can count on one hand the number of teaching hospitals that are being contemplated or built. And so it's nice to have one of them right here in our community. And
we've been waiting for this.
I'm glad we got it done. Now we just got to get it built, and so that's going to be our next focus. And you'll see that happening rapidly.
That's wonderful. And you said you plan on in the future keeping people out of beds.
Yes.
How do you plan?
So let's talk about that a little bit. So if you think about where healthcare is today, our system is designed and is paid. We pay for sick care. That's the way the system is designed. So unfortunately, there has not been incentives in place to really be proactive on managing populations. And so we have formed with our medical staff, and we have 227 docs that have signed up with us so far, called what's it called, a clinical integration organization, where we share clinical quality data, and we actually work together with the payers to do a better job around population health. So we're doing this, we're starting with our employees at Sierra Providence. So our employees at Dependents, we have about 4,500 folks that we care for. And we're working with the docs, and we're saying, gosh, guys, where can we be more efficient? How do we be, do a better job of focusing on wellness, focusing on keeping people with chronic disease, making sure they stay up to date on all the things they need to so they don't need more interventions, right? And so part of how that works is working with the payers and the physicians is finding those opportunities for shared savings. So for example, if you tell a physician, gosh, we want you to stop doing all this stuff, we want you to do this and that, that's fine, but they're extremely busy, and ultimately, if it just means they're gonna get paid less, it's really, really hard to get them all that excited. Whereas if I say, look, gosh, here's my employee base, last year I spent $14 million for healthcare. If we work together and reduce redundancy, try to find ways to communicate better, and we reduce that by $2 million, I'm gonna share half the savings with you, right? So we have to have incentives so that everybody's aligned, because right now that's just not the case. And so a big part of it is monitoring those incentives. And you might say, well, gosh, you're in the hospital business. Why would you want to keep people out of your hospital? But I would say that I think going forward, there's going to be less admissions. There's less admissions this year than there was last year. There will be less admissions the year after. That's even with someone joining Medicare every 5 minutes. And so we have incredible Medicare growth. The population's getting older. But the reason that's happening is technology. Technology's bringing it to the outpatient setting. So if you guys go back 20 years ago and you had your gallbladder out, you were in the hospital for 5 days. Now you're there lucky for their 5 hours, right? So you think about kind of the way the technology is changing, we expect there to be much less inpatient hospital admissions. Now with that said, when you need a hospital, and there will always be a need for them, you really need it. And so our goal is, for that less intensive stuff, how do we make it cheaper? How do we get it out of the hospital setting, make it more outpatient? But when you need us, be there for you, right? And part of that is we have to be part of the solution for people like the school district. I'm well aware healthcare is a big line item for you guys, right? So if we're smart and working together, there should be real opportunities for us to both do the right thing and also, you know, help drive wellness, help drive presenteeism. It's a big deal for employees, employers, everything else. We have to get much more integrated on that stuff. I think I'm way too much of your time. Sorry.
No, no, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You made our attention. Thank you.
Do you have a card?
I have. You know what? I'm sure that I do. I should. Yes, I do. 1 second.
You guys can feel free to contact me anytime.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. All right. I'll take a picture. You guys can take it.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night. Ms. Gomez, next agenda item, please.
Item 3, Board of Trustee Business. A discussion and possible action on committee structure.
Mr. Rodriguez?
Just real quick, yeah, I wanted to bring this agenda item, just because there's been some serious concern on my part, and I don't know if the rest of the board feels the same concern. But when you look at our committee structure and the discussions we've had, and I'm sure Letty and Rachel remember when our previous attorney advised us on the committee structure and what we needed to do. I don't see it continuing to happen, and I don't know if, I didn't know Steve was going to be here, but if Steve wants to touch on that, I just have issues within committee structure, and I think we need to realign ourselves to more of an efficient organization, but at the same time, allow for opportunities. And I think my thinking is first direct administration to look at other districts, look at high performing districts, and see how they operate, then come back to us on whether it's policy we need to change or what is it we need to look at. So if anybody has any questions or discussions before I make a motion.
I would agree that we need to look at the structure as what's included in the content.
particularly our bond program within our facilities, finance, audit, facilities, and planning committee. It is such a large portion, and it should be treated more in a special meeting arena. But I think as the legal, the BDB legal stands, they are advisory committees as they stand. I think I would entertain possibly separating bond out from these committees, but still keep the structure as is, only because I've seen the efficiency, and I do believe the advisory role as they are intended to be are very well worth it, and I don't really see the need. I know that our attorney may think otherwise, but as long as we adhere to the advisory committee, to the advisory role of these committees, as well as recommending and not really deciding in those meetings, I really don't see why we need to restructure. I may not be alone in this, but I know that I've never heard any concern from either administration other than our attorney that these may be real special meetings versus committee meetings.
Ms. Mendoza.
Mr. Medina, is it your suggestion that a special committee be formed for the purpose of the bond and the finances and
the... No, specifically just a board meeting, a special board meeting dealing only with the bond.
Okay.
Simple, because of what the amount of information and the opportunity to really have not only a board meeting, a special board meeting that deal with the bond, but also have another opportunity during a regular board meeting to catch up. That way we have 2 points during the month to essentially make decisions on large items like the bond.
Right, but not necessarily.
Not a committee. Not a committee. To break out that function of a bond, CBAC would be involved, and it would only be bond. That way it'd be a lot easier. Separate really the facilities portion of it, because we kind of lose sort of the facilities portion of it. Not that by any means the reporting, there's just a lot of information to absorb at one time.
Anybody else? Ms. Searle.
I do. I have to say that I like our committee meetings, and the main reason being is that the public can be there. They can have discourse with us, which does not happen in a regular meeting. It will never happen. It's against the Open Meetings Act. And that is where I feel we provide our community the opportunity to have a discourse, to have some type of communication directly with the board and with board members who are obviously concerned about certain issues, because that's what the name of their committee would lead you to believe. And I see that changing that takes away community participation. And I know that at the Facilities Committee, we do get community participation, and it's a breath of fresh air, actually, to see that people can come, they can have discourse, instead of, as we all know, right now, this gentleman sitting in the audience cannot talk to us, no matter how badly he wants to talk to us. And it doesn't matter what he's got to say, under the Open Meetings Act, he's not going to be able to talk to us. But if we were at a committee meeting, he can talk to us. And he can actually tell us, yeah, this is good, or no, that's bad. And it's an advisory role, and all we do is make a recommendation to the board. Yet we have now heard from the committee and from the community. So I think I don't think it gets any better personally. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Earls. Mr. Rodriguez.
Just real quick, and I want some clarification. If you look at community participation, I think that's critical. I think there's ways that we can incorporate it when it comes to even our board meetings. It's not, the Open Meetings Act is not against community participation. They allow it if we were to look at our local policy and allow it. We could even allow it we allow it just at the beginning. Also allow it throughout the meeting if we wanted to. I think what we can do is look at providing, I just want to see what's the optimal. And so my recommendation would be to, one, go look at workshops or a certain way, whether it's a special meeting of the bond program, whatever it may be, that that way we organize the whole thing. When you look at not only decisions that are being made at committee, that's one concern, and that's where the legal part comes out. I think the other question comes to, is it right just for certain board members to get all the information instead of the whole board as a whole, so we can make sound decisions as a whole? So the reason why I brought this item up was one, the legalities, and two, be more efficient. So I guess Ms. Searles has something she wants to add.
Ms. Searles? Well, I do, because there's the other issue of time. And you can look back through the minutes of all of our meetings. It'd be a miracle if we were ever out of here before 10 o'clock, which is wrong. Really, that's very late anyhow. If we did not have those committee meetings to fully vet, we would either be making ill-informed decisions and or we'd be there for maybe 2 days. We'd be sitting in these chairs because there's just too much information and too much to take in. And I also have never noticed this administration not freely giving what's given to one, given to all. Unless, I've never seen that happen. When anything happens, I know for Ms. Gonzalez's committee, I get information. And I feel very satisfied, and if I'm not, I ask for more, and it's always fine. So, for whatever it's worth, I see it as time and efficiency and as community participation. But we are doing a good thing. And actually, I see us as a model for best practice.
Mr. Medina, are you done?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Medina?
Well, the other issue, I think we hit it last week, where we had Lori's committee run a little late because of the amount of bonds that they had on there. And we didn't have enough opportunity to update for the board packet. So we may want to change the timing of our committee to allow a little bit of flexibility between the board meetings and the regular board meetings. And the reason I say this is we literally have two meetings back to back that are, you know, Monday and Wednesday, and then you have to have a board meeting, board packet out by Thursday, and we have to digest all that information. They have to prepare it, and a lot of times, and I think this was the case, they just didn't want to put out incorrect information, so they just put the same information in there, which is, there's nothing wrong with that, it was just a timing issue. So if maybe we space out the committee meetings to the week where we kept it instead of moving it up, which was the suggestion, where we leave it the second week of the month for a committee, leave the third week open, so we have the minutes to the committee chairs, because I've noticed that the committee chairs don't get the minutes in time. They review them here. You guys review them here because it's always, we're running, and I think since we're in full control of these procedures and how we time ourselves, I think it should give us enough time to not only digest the information that was vetted at the committee, but also give the administration enough time to properly give the minutes for review to the committee chairs, as well as for us to digest all this information. So I think there's a way to skin that, but I still don't see us as not being efficient. In fact, the legal portion of this, our policy, allows for committees, but I do agree, maybe there's another way to look at it. I do know that EPIC and Anthony, they all have special board meetings, but that there's quite a bit of them. And there might be some issue of quorum. I don't know if everybody can make every single one of them. So I think this allows that flexibility. That's just my thoughts on it.
Can I just clarify something? I don't want to get rid of the meetings. I think we still need to have the meetings. Now, let's look at it on a legal standpoint. On the legalities, is okay, committee, should it be committee? Should it be a workshop? Should it be a special board meeting? And so when you're looking at this, that's why I would like to give administration, hey, go with our auditors to go look at best practices, high efficient, sort of, I agree, we have to meet on a monthly basis when it comes to bond and facilities, pretty much.
Well, just bond by itself.
Which includes, it's the same thing, but the reason why this came out was because there was a facilities committee, there was a finance committee, there was a, you know, and so we just try to include it.
So much.
So pretty much facilities and bond is the same thing, whatever. We name it, whatever. I'm not looking at naming it. I'm just saying, let's go back. Let's come outside the box. Think of the best way we could come about this and run a more efficient organization. Allow every individual board member to participate in that, whether it's a workshop or a special board meeting, but then we all are allowed to have discussion, whatever it may be, and then it goes to the board meeting. So I'm not saying that's minimized. What I'm saying is, how do we run a better thing, allow all board members, and then run it the way it's supposed to be? So how we do that, I don't know. I'm just asking if we could ask administration and our auditor to look at it, see what recommendations they come, and then we could have a workshop on that to say, okay, this actually sounds good. It might not sound good, but at least we are looking at how we can. But I think there's a possible way where we could all come together and move the organization forward. So,
Mr. Medina?
I don't know if this is a function for audit. I think it's more for administration. I think audit's got enough to do on their plate. But I do have a question for administration. What's your thought? I mean,
we talked about how
to prepare for it as well.
I don't think it's a board administration either. It's a function of the board and how you want to operate. Perfect. We could bring you best practices or models of other ways to do things. But to say this is the right model, this is the correct model, because I'm not a board member, I'm an administration. So how you want to operate is in your purview. Some of the things I do have to answer or ask is, what are the purposes of committees? Define efficiency, define effectiveness. So those are questions I'm having. Again, we can go out and look at all have to execute the model. How do you see fit? So that would be my answer. And when it comes to committees, and I was talking to some of the executive directors about committees, it's about the redundancy. It's about consent being pulled, and then we have to go back and go over it again. You know, we go, with all due respect to Ms. Gonzalez, we get out, but then I would say your meetings are efficient and effective.
Oh, yes.
Because we celebrate. Criticism to you, Ms. Searles, but that they are longer. It is because of the month. But when we put everything together and we come out on Tuesday and the consent is read, and then all of a sudden, it's like the alphabet, and you see the idea of how we're regurgitating all this information again for more. And it already has gone through a committee. So maybe the communication between the committee and the board member who's dissenting needs to happen before you consent the agenda. That's just my opinion.
Mr. Chair, that's really what I was going for, is a lot more time for communication to happen. I don't think we're giving enough time between the the actual committees themselves in the regular board meetings, and that's why you do have consent agendas, because of the lack of communication. So I really do think that if we're going to start to look at efficiency, I think bond, if you look at how much time that takes on just one committee, we could shave that committee meeting in half. Would you agree, Mr. Padilla? Yes. And you can still have facilities and update as well. I mean, aside from your bond. So I think I would kind of make that motion now to separate the bond portion from the finance, audit, facilities, and planning committee and place it on the special board meeting to be determined at a later date. The other primary language.
Mr. Rodriguez.
And I totally agree with you. And I think lack of communication is one of the most important things. And so when you're having, let's say, a committee structure in the way it's supposed to run, because if not, and I guess, Steve, do you want to address some other issues? I mean, when we first got on, you questioned the committee structure, and then you brought it up several occasions when I was the president. So if you want to.
Sure. You have a legal policy and you have a local policy. The local policy allows you to have certain standing committees. The committees were all posted in accordance with the Open Meetings Act, and that's done for two reasons. First reason is the Senate committee serves in an advisory capacity and does more than just say this is what we recommend. You're really actually vetting the issue and reviewing it in person. So even if the committees only had attendance by the committee members, we still recommend you post it. The second reason that you post your committee meetings is because invariably you will have a quorum of the board and committee. This is not illegal, it's not a violation of any rule or the Open Meetings Act, but what you are really doing when you have a quorum attend a committee meeting is you're actually having a board meeting. Anytime you have a quorum with the full board attending, you're required to post it in compliance with the Open Meetings Act because that's considered a meeting of the board. So how do you address that, and what do lawyers, I guess, I don't want to say it's nitpicky, but it's a technicality that's important. If the committee is three people, the committee should be those three people. It shouldn't be four people, five people, six people, or seven people. It ought to be the committee handling that committee's business. If other board members want to attend the meeting, you're obviously free to welcome to do it. But you shouldn't be advised. You should be in the audience listening to the committee's business, because the committee is the entity charged, and that group of people are the ones chosen to make the recommendation to review the issues to the board. You can continue with the practice that you've done. And I understand the committee meetings, I don't attend many of them, but you'll have more than the committee at the dais. And I'm not saying that's wrong. It's essentially what you're doing is you're having a special board meeting. And here's why. Because the committees are supposed to be advisory. Well, you have four people, and if all four people are not in agreement that that's what we're going to do, we'll have a charity pass judgment on the issue you're considering. So you're really having a special board meeting. So lawyers will tell you, I'm not the only one that's done it, other lawyers will tell you the same thing, you're really having a special board meeting. That's not to say you can't have the same committee structure, just sit in the audience as opposed to class. This came up one time where it was a real issue for 22. We had a committee meeting posted. You have to have at least two members of the committee to have a quorum. You only had one committee member here, but you had two other board members who were not on the committee attend the meeting. And there was a bit of a disagreement as to whether that committee meeting could go forward. Legally, it couldn't, because it's not a quorum of full board, so it's not a meeting. And it's not a quorum of the committee. You have one committee member, two non-committee members. Those non-committee members, without action from the president, can't step in and take over as committee members. So, it's not that we're being critical of you, we're just being technical and saying what a committee really is. It's in your policy, it describes it, it defines it, and I think you just got a little bit out of the habit of following it the way it's normally done.
Ms. Searles? Yes, in our policy, BPB, it says here committee meetings shall be posted as work sessions.
Right.
And I don't think we are.
You are. You're not taking any action technically at the committees because you don't vote. You do this.
I don't think we are posting in this work session.
We do. It says in the notice of the committee meeting, it says that all discussion and deliberation will be for formulation and recommendations only to the full board, and no action will be taken. It's kind of in the middle of the first part of the.
But I'm thinking at the top of the agenda.
But it just says committee meeting.
Yeah, it doesn't say
that's correct.
A workshop at all, and or a work session. So maybe that's where we're dropping the ball. It's not calling it a work session.
I don't really have a legal issue with calling it a work session or a committee meeting. You might want to better define it. The policy says it should be labeled a work session. You can call it that. The notice has the language that you need to have in the notice to say what the committee is supposed to be doing. And again, it's not that when you do what you do, you've done anything wrong. I don't want anybody to feel like we're saying all the action you're taking is improper, it's wrong. It's not wrong. It's just you're not really having a committee meeting. You're really having, you have more than three members present to have a special meeting.
Or would you be having a work session, a work session?
Yeah, you call exactly.
And so would that be the very easy bridge to go over, that we don't call them committee meetings anymore? We call them board work sessions, as it's called for here, and somehow reflect that? Because We've got good policy.
You could, but then you have to make sure you have board people present.
Yeah.
We're calling a work session of a full board.
Just make it a committee.
The language is archaic. It's called a committee of the whole. That's the body that is this group here, your committee of the whole. The whole board is like your committee. It's got your... You could have a work session if you wanted to, but you need to have a forum to make it happen.
Mr. Medina.
So, in reality, what you're saying is whoever's on the committee should be on the dais. Whoever's not on the committee, be not on the dais. That's, if we stick to that, we're good and clear. And
oh, sure.
Then, and I don't think there's anything wrong with it. We just follow
the procedure. I'm not saying that your seats are comfortable.
Yeah, that's why.
Yeah. So
those are more comfortable.
I'm not saying you can't do it. And there's nothing wrong if you're sitting there, like, I'll not to pick on this retreat. Corner. If you have a committee and there's three of you in the middle, and he just happens to want to be working on some stuff or reading some stuff, he can be there. Where you start to run into technicalities is when you start participating in the committee meeting. You're not a member of the committee. So why are you participating in the committee meeting when you're not on that committee?
Because you're a member of the public.
Ms. Gonzalez.
So you go down there and get to be the okay.
Ms. Gonzalez.
I think you just answered the question. One clarification, actually. My minutes have been on time, and I think that last time we agreed that if they were not on time, they were not going to be put on the agenda, correct? Okay, so the other question is clarifying now. So there's three of us here, and one board member's talking with over there. Is that quorum?
Yes. That's what we were. That's what you're careful to post it.
As a committee.
If it's a committee and there's another board member talking over there.
If they're talking to the committee, then you're having a meeting.
So they can't even address the committee.
No, I don't want to say that because we're careful. We know that happens and you can plan in advance.
So it should be.
You post it. As long as you've given notice of the topic to be discussed and the time and date of the meeting, you can get together and
I don't think anybody's coming with guns to arrest us.
Somebody.
I really don't.
So, I mean, we can come to a meeting, but we can't.
Well, I'm not talking about just from the meeting.
Not participate.
Of course you can attend. And if you want to say something, if you want to participate, you can, because we're careful to post it.
Because all the information that is shared is very, very, it's a lot of information.
Here's where you get in trouble. If you look at your policy, BDB legal, it has a clause in there that says when a committee meets and it doesn't have control over the board's business, you don't have to post it. You can have committee meetings and not post meetings under the Open Meetings Act, as long as all you're doing is getting together to discuss general business. There's not an agenda, there's not topics, you're not formulating recommendations of the board. You're just going to get together because you want to talk about stuff in general.
Nobody does that.
There's not going to be a lawyer that's going to recommend you do that, but you're going to say, no, be safe, what's the big deal?
Just post
a notice saying, here's what we're going to talk about.
Yeah,
if someone else wants to attend, they can go ahead and attend. It's just safety sake. The problem you have is when you're all at the dais, if somebody wants to be critical of you, but I don't think this has happened here, I'm not saying that it ever has. They can say you're circumventing the Open Meetings Act by agreeing at the committee and people aren't coming. And then when you come to the board meeting, you guys have already talked about an important issue, you agree to the committee, and you don't really discuss it with the board. I'm not saying that's happened, but that's the criticism.
So I have a question.
Yes, sir.
So what's the difference between agree and recommend?
If it's from the committee, you all can't, as a member of the body of three people, you don't have enough votes to say that a decision has been made on that issue. Once you add the fourth person, like I said, you're all at a committee meeting, you're not even saying, we're going to represent the board that we do X, Y, or Z. You've got four votes necessary to pass any item on an agenda at a future meeting. It's only a matter of counting, I guess, is the way to look at it.
Yep. Legally, I'm reading BDB legal, that all of what we're doing is obviously what you can do. A committee that includes one or more board members and has supervision or control over public business or public policy
is subject to the Open Meetings Act when it needs to discuss that public business or policy,
correct,
which we do.
Correct.
And goes on to say that it serves as purely advisory function.
Unless the form with no power or control,
yeah,
is not subject to the Open Meetings Act. We don't do that. And that's the part that I'm saying that we would never recommend and try to do. You can have them, and there, you know, there are, they'll have a, I don't know, let me give you an idea. Some entities have had agenda building committees. You get together as a group of three, seven-person board, to discuss what is going to be on the agenda, when you're going to meet, who you want there. That's purely advisory, and it doesn't have the power to supervise or control the business. You can have that kind of a committee meeting and not post it. I can tell you now that if somebody were to ask us, can we do that, should we post it, even though we don't have to, we would still say, well, why don't you post it? You're just running extra risk when you don't have to.
Mr. Corona.
You know, one of the things I think that we ought to try and do have more stuff from the committees and the special board meetings, because we kind of go over this stuff again, and some of us don't get to actually see that information full blown. So the communication from the minutes or the notes of the committee, I don't think is sufficient to give you the flavor of what happened, sure, when it's something that's really a large item. So in that respect, I agree, specifically bond stuff. That I agree we need to have more board meetings than. Should we get rid of completely all the committees? I don't know. I mean, sometimes there's use for them. And I'm kind of, you know, the double-edged deal of the, we can find a way to get more community input into the special board meetings we have. I think we really ought to rather just go to special board meetings. We're all there, at least four of us are there, and we don't have to rehash this stuff. And I think it would cut down our monthly board meetings type, because we get mired in some of the stuff we pull out that some of us haven't heard completely because we weren't at the committee meeting. And I agree, it's a fine line between at the committee meeting when somebody speaks out and says in favor of it, another board member, even though they're in the audience. It's a fine line that we're treading. And so, I don't know.
Instead of calling them committee meetings, you could do exactly what Mr. Earl suggested. You're going to have finance, audit, facilities, and planning work sessions. Whatever your date is of the board, and then you're going to have at least four board members that have to be present to hold that meeting. If you ever only have three, you fail for lack of a quorum for the same reason.
So there'd be no committee members, is that correct?
No meeting.
Right, you wouldn't have, you could have, you'd still have the chair of that
work session,
whoever it might be, you appoint them in different fashions, you still do that.
Mr. Rodriguez.
I think, you know, either work session or, I mean, the district is growing. You know, where, you know, we had, and if you go back to history, and you said you have pretty much tidy facilities committee, finance committee. I mean, there's some where we could even just align it to the CFO and the CAO. You know, anything that falls under those, there would be a special board meeting to address those, and then it's the whole public. So I felt in the past we've stretched a little, and I just don't want to stretch anymore. And so I wanted to bring it up as president, but I don't want to step on, you know, so I just think we need to look at it and then look at, I guess, look at the way our organizational structure is, so that way it's aligned. So that way you don't have the people in finance here, and you don't have people in HR here, and you don't have, you know, somebody in curriculum where those people can take it over. So I'm thinking, how do we just look at the organizational structure and align it to our committees as well? And then I would recommend that we would go on a special meeting of, you know, and if we have to do a workshop, maybe we could add that wording in there. So I think that curriculum workshop that we had the last time was something good. So it allows us to be flexible, and that allows a chair, the president, to say, okay, you know, this is more of a workshop, you know. We don't need that much decisions that need to be made. It's more of an informational. I don't know. I'm just saying, how do we go look at it and then come back to the board with something to change?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Mr. Blanco, so what I'm hearing from you, though, is that if we could just go on living life as we do, and I'm probably the worst offender because I really do like to sit in the comfortable chair. And so I'll on my own back that if I just go sit down there with Mr. De Leon, everything's okay.
Yeah, what you're doing now is not
and
illegal.
Just listen. And okay.
Yeah, I'm not saying anything that you, if we thought, and this was an issue when we first started with the district that we noticed and we brought up, that's just the way you do business. I'm not saying that it's wrong, it's just there's other ways to do it that don't leave room for criticism on how you're handling your committee business.
So
we're not doing anything that's illegal, and we're not planning to, by law, have to change.
So the easiest thing would be that the three members of the committee can be here and the rest down there.
Correct.
And everything's great?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rose. Mr. Medina.
One question, have we received any concerns from the community at large or administration about any concerns of our openness or our decision making? Has any in the past at Blanco?
To me?
Yes.
Not from this administration, but from the prior administration, I had a lot of questions about why are we doing this, extra meetings, time constraints, and so we actually gave the initial opinion because of that issue, but no, I'm not. You know, Dr. Galavis and I talking about it, not in a way that somebody has criticized it, or the public has made it an issue.
My name is football.
Oh, God.
What I would recommend is that two drafts come before us, one being a special board meeting of however it's going to align to the district as we grow, and then the other one would be to the work session. So come back, and maybe another draft is something else you might look better to the board, and then that way we could have that discussion. So that would be my motion.
Do you have a
second? I'll second.
We have a motion and a second. Ms.
Gomez. Mr.
Coronado. Yes.
Mrs. Gonzalez.
Yes.
Mr. Medina.
Yes.
Mrs. Mendoza.
Yes.
Mrs. Quintana.
Yes.
Mr. Rodriguez.
Yes.
Mrs. Servis.
Yes.
I guess, again, somewhat nebulous what you're asking.
How about we're
also, I hear Mr. Medina saying, let's keep our committee meetings the second week, have a week off, not off, but a room for a special board meeting, and then the fourth
regular board meeting.
Regular board meeting.
Just that, makes sense. Well,
when you look at, if I might real quick.
Is that the clarification? Is that what I mean?
Yeah. Well, you've got a motion, I mean, because that was my initial sort of motion was to separate the board, the bond completely out of finance, and to separate the meetings within a week of each other. That was my initial motion.
Didn't just
a second.
On policy, I mean, the chair has the authority to move that board meeting without even. What I would recommend is if we could appoint a task force. I think maybe me, Adrian, or Lethe, and we could have a committee to task force to look at it, come up with some ideas, and then look at those two options, and then we'll present it to the board. And then, you know, that if we move specifically, I think, you know, whoever, let's say if we do go to a committee or a work session structure or just a special board meeting of, then that could automatically be removed. If we set it in policy to move the board meeting on a committee meeting, that kind of, I think it might cause more of a problem.
It's also being a little more open, I mean. That's the way I see it, is if we set down a guideline, we sort of stick to that guideline versus being so flexible that the committee chair can decide to move it at any point. I mean, it has to be extenuated with circumstances.
Oh, well, we could put a guideline. So I guess the best thing would be to discuss those. I'm willing to volunteer on that committee and whoever else would. And then that way we could bring those drafts to the
So you You say we're going to make a committee for committees.
No, we're going to make a committee, which is, we're not going to.
Just going to
be three board meetings, and that's, I mean, three board members, and that's it, no more.
And I guess it begs to ask the question, where does your legislative committee work into this?
This is different from my legislative.
I know, but it's also a standing committee.
Correct. Well, it would be a work session. We're going to have a work session.
So we can all talk about that in this.
Yeah, okay. We could. So whoever else wants to
Do you want to report to Dr. Valadez?
Yeah, we'll meet with Dr. Valadez.
And whoever wants to volunteer, call Dr.
But it can be more than three, unless we're going to have a
You technically, President Quintana, you need to appoint members to any special committee. You can have a special committee to address specific issues that are outside the standing committees. That's what this is.
So anybody wanting to be on that?
And I'll volunteer.
Just let me know.
Text me or email me or
call me.
To the next board meeting, you'll appoint.
So I have a question.
Yes, Mr. Earl.
You can make the appointment.
We've got some committee meetings coming up next week.
We'll follow the same process.
We can do notes.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Yes,
okay.
Committees or committees?
Okay. Ms. Gomez.
Item 4, executive session. The time is now 7:26 p.m. and the meeting is to be called under Texas Government Code Sections 551.071 and 551.074. A discussion regarding recommendation of Northwest Urban College High School principal. A discussion regarding board operating procedures.
This takes us into executive session and it is 7.
Is there a reason why we have
27?
The board operating procedures in an executive session. I thought that was going to sort of be like a work session.
I think it's just for discussion. Because I know that
there
were interested in it.
Well, I sent an email too to make sure we had an action item. So that way,
Well, I think it's going to take more to have a discussion. I think we'll probably need to take it. What's a workshop tour?
And is there a reason why we're going to have a session?
Not that I know, it's just to discuss.
It's allowed. Duties of officers are allowed to discuss in the session. So allowed to